published alongside people I adored and admired, I got a terrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. That night, the year before, I had been raped. I still didn't want to talk about it. I got the book deal I'd been in talks for to write Outdated, Why Dating is Ruining Your Love Life. It was an honest look at how women incorporate their feminist ideals into their romantic lives, specifically geared towards strong, feminist women who also happen to have that one terrible flaw. We date men and have to navigate the ins and outs of patriarchy while doing so. I wrote an entire book about love and dating and sex without mentioning having been raped. Not to my editor or to most of my friends. I did travel the country speaking to college students about the importance of women being brave, speaking for themselves, and telling their own stories. I became a campus evangelist for feminist blogging, the revelatory, connected, speaking truth to power kind. Women would come up to me after my talks to tell me about the things with which they were grappling. Sexism at school, the sexualization of their bodies, the pressure to be feminine, the pressure to have it all, and, of course, rape culture on campus. I helped women tell their stories about rape without talking about my own story of being raped. I also stopped having sex for a long time. The first time I did it again, I sobbed uncontrollably, trying to hide it from the overly eager man who I'd let inside me. It happened the next time I had sex too. I put on weight, digging myself deeper into overeating or drinking too much. I threw myself into my work too. At least I had my work. I helped women tell their stories, I thought. My story isn't as serious. It isn't as important. I'm dealing with it. I am okay. The chasm between my vocation and my story kept growing the more I worked. If I had been raped, could I still be strong? Could I still teach other women how to escape the gripping, harsh reality of rape culture? If I had succumbed to the forces that silence women about their own assaults? I kept silent. I doubled down. Instead of encouraging women to tell their stories, I started editing the stories of women who had been raped. I've had to rigorously analyze and fact-check their stories, knowing that they are probably true, but having to navigate a professional system, journalism, inextricably tied to the legal one in which they won't be believed or in which their cases are hard to prove. Shaking, sometimes, but editing stories that are so close to mine. A girl unconscious raped in college. A girl raped by her boyfriend. A girl raped by someone she loves. A girl raped at a party. A girl raped by a friend. Women like me, and yet not me, because they were doing what I couldn't do. Tell my story. The constant drumbeat of stories of sexual assault, from R. Kelly to our own goddamn president, keep me in a constant state of post-rape PTSD. Some days, I feel like I have to hold my breath just to read the news, so I can get through it and on with my workday. I am two parts of the system. I am an editor, and I was victimized and survived the same thing I'm reading, writing, and editing. People often get into this work to help survivors and to grapple with their own stories. I dug myself deeper into it to avoid grappling with mine. Last year, I was invited to a retreat about storytelling to talk about how to bring your most authentic self into your professional life, how to live a life that is not manufactured for your career, but a reflection of who you deeply are. It was on that retreat that my silence began to unravel after listening to one of my best friends share something I already knew with a room full of near strangers, that she had been sexually assaulted. She had learned somewhere in the interim to do more than simply reveal what had happened to her. She had learned to tell the story of it so that it didn't become her only story. And as I listened to her, as I watched her be an encourager of other people's storytelling, an independent, smart woman, and a survivor of sexual assault, I felt, finally, like maybe my story was worthy of telling too, and maybe I was worth the telling of it. And so, I told it.
Not That Loud. Quiet Encounters with Rape Culture by Miriam Soyla Perez. I keep a list of everyone I've ever kissed, 24 people, in my journal. I started it sometime post-college when my romantic and sexual life picked up considerably after coming out as queer. The first name on the list is not even a name. Boys at Spin the Bottle Party, age 11. There were three that night, I think. Two of them were brothers. About half the entries have asterisks next to their names, my own not-so-subtle way of indicating that we had sex. Since the vast majority of the people whom I've kissed, 18, aren't cisgender men, the definition of what constitutes sex is a bit murky. It's hard, even for me, to shake the heteronormative definitions ingrained in me since childhood. I can't even tell you at this point what exactly I did with the woman who was 10th on the list that constituted sex. I remember a picnic dinner on her bedroom floor. I remember her wrought iron headboard. I remember I got higher than I wanted to before we hooked up. But at the time that I documented our relationship on my strange, bordering on obsessive list, I'd felt like we'd had sex. So I scribbled a sloppy star next to her last name. A few years ago, I noticed another pattern among my sexual partners, undocumented on my list. My lovers were, more often than not, survivors of sexual abuse. The fact of it had registered in my subconscious, but it wasn't until last summer, when I was dating someone new and we both admitted that neither of us were survivors, that I realized just how unusual such a situation is in my sexual history. The person I was dating shared a history so similar to my own, of partnering and sleeping with many survivors, and teared up as they talked about how unfair it was that so many of their lovers had been harmed in that way. Sexual assault is no longer an undercurrent in political life. It shouts at us from news headlines, colors the electoral debates, shapes rally slogans and protest chants. But something doesn't have to be loud to be deafening, to suck up all the oxygen in the room, to shroud the windows and dim the lights. In my personal life, sexual abuse has been a barely audible, inescapable presence when I have sex. It's a silent partner as I get to know a new lover, learn what they like and don't like in bed, how they want to be touched, what is off limits. I rarely learn the details of my lover's experiences. Sometimes they never even call themselves survivors. But I know those experiences are nonetheless there, in the shadows in the corner of bedrooms and living rooms and kitchens. They showed up in the whispers of one lover, "Don't ever put your hands around my neck," and in the tears of another every time she climaxed in the 5 years that we were together. Being invited to engage with someone in an intimate way, to entwine your lips with theirs, to slip your tongue into their mouth, to put your hands on their body in ways that no one else does, is a gift, an act of vulnerability and trust. So when that almost inevitable moment comes when I realize that, for a new lover, this act that we are undertaking together once began for them as a violation, my stomach faithfully drops. The best I can do, usually, is to try and stay present and loving, as an act of resistance and reclamation. I'd like to think that the fact that so many of my partners are survivors is exceptional. Maybe it's because I'm queer, maybe it's because I'm Latinx, a child of immigrants, maybe it's because many of my partners are people of color and immigrants too. I know the statistics that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys, based on how they were assigned at birth, are sexually abused as children. I know that for people of color, especially Black and Latinx folks, those rates are even higher. In the grand scheme of things, even though the kiss list in my journal takes up a full page, my sample size is small. It's likely that many of my friends are survivors too, or that many of them find themselves having the same realization over and over again with new lovers as I do. I know that my own trauma shapes all of my relationships and interactions. Though I'm not a survivor and I wasn't sexually abused as a child, my early family dynamics have left me with all sorts of distorted ways of relating to others. I'm a caretaker and a caregiver, a top and a caballero if I'm feeling romantic and want to reclaim my machista Cuban roots in my own queer feminist way. But the shadow side of it means that my default is to put other people's needs and desires before my own. In some ways, my instinct to put myself last has served me well in my relationships, particularly with the partners who've experienced sexual abuse. Being deferential, attentive, and accommodating has helped my lovers feel some sense of safety as they navigated their own complicated relationships with sex and boundaries as survivors. But I was also forced to confront that, in other ways, my selflessness may be the result of my own coping mechanisms and be reinforcing unhealthy approaches to sex. If I peruse my list of partners, there are probably only one or two people about whom I could say confidently that our relationship never involved any sex that I performed out of obligation rather than actual desire. Then, during sex with a relatively new partner recently, we agreed at the outset of one encounter that we would focus on my pleasure. A few minutes into it, I burst into sobs and cried for the better part of 10 minutes. I didn't know exactly why. I still don't. I know it has something to do with my high school boyfriend. It usually does, right? Well, boyfriend is probably a loose term. We'd met on a youth group ski trip during which I'd given him an unreciprocated hand job without as much as a kiss. The lack of reciprocation continued as our relationship evolved into a hookup game of defend the goal. His goal, my defense. Including after junior prom, when I'd almost let him enter me in the parking lot of a shuttered CVS. But stopped short because I decided that losing my virginity on prom night to someone I wasn't even technically dating was too cliche. Some of the details of the night a week later are crystal clear. We were in the back seat of my 2-door Honda Civic, it was dark, we were in a parking lot, and Lauryn Hill's To Zion was playing on my car stereo. I wasn't really sure if I wanted to have sex with him, but the boundaries I put up were weak at best, and he dutifully approached them over and over until I conceded. It was painful and brief. I remember he didn't orgasm, which was unusual. And though my life no longer involves being pressured into sex in a car with a boy that I didn't really want and never enjoyed, it's hard to escape wondering why it is that, in encounters I wanted and even initiated, it's rare that I seek the same pleasure I want to give to other people. I know that there is a huge divide between feeling pressured into having sex too quickly by a high school boyfriend and being sexually abused, but some version of those violations and so many others have so thoroughly shaped all of my sexual and romantic relationships that I no longer really can imagine a world in which I could have sex that didn't resonate with some sort of trauma. Rape interferes with how my partners and I can experience joy and connection, even within incredibly loving, supportive, and non-normative relationships. Rape culture means that even as someone who realized just how non-consensual that high school relationship was just a few months after it ended, I still struggle with the repercussions of that experience and the many that followed it. Even though I had the strength to confront that boyfriend over AOL Instant Messenger to tell him just how I felt about our relationship, in the form of a badly written and very emo poem, of course, I kept doing sexual things that I didn't really want to do for years after. When I interviewed activist and writer Adrian Marie Brown, we spoke about her work as a pleasure activist, and her perspective on sexual honesty stuck with me for days after our conversation. What becomes possible when we're being real with each other? She asked. Maybe your feelings get hurt when I tell you I don't like the way you're touching me. How many times have I hesitated to tell a partner what I liked or didn't like for fear of hurting their feelings, for fear of having to care for their emotions in the aftermath of that disclosure? I thought to myself as she talked. But what is possible after that? She continued. Learning new ways of touching. Once you've experienced that erotic awakening, you cannot settle for suffering. That's where I live now. I won't settle for suffering. I won't settle for small compromises of my own desires in service of others' needs, for ignoring my own truths, or for trying to take the easy route of not naming the elephant at the foot of the bed when I'm being sexual with lovers. We don't have any power over what we've experienced. We can't change our own or undo the harm that was done to those around us. But we can make different choices. I can try with every kiss, every touch, every orgasm, with every new person who invites me to share in intimacy with them, to believe that another world is possible, and that I'm building it with every new name I add to the silly list in my journal.
Why I Stopped by Zoe Medeiros. When I first started to tell people what happened to me, I told anyone who showed the tiniest bit of interest, and I told as much as they could bear to hear, which was always a vanishingly small proportion of what actually happened, and it was never enough. I was young, and it was new to me to talk about it, and for a moment I became almost drunk with the power of speaking it aloud, deliriously revealing the worst things to people with whom I wouldn't trust my bus fare these days. I don't tell anyone now, not the details anyway,
not what actually happened. There is a woman who is one of my best friends and dear to my heart. We walk our dogs together for hours in all weather. We talk over everything. And if someone has been the tiniest bit mean to me, she shouts, "We hate them," and plots their immediate downfall. There is a man with whom I work every day, who knows the intricacies of my family situation, who brings me coffee on the days when I'm falling asleep at my desk, who always does his best by me. I haven't told them. I'm not going to tell you. It did not help me to tell. I felt a momentary burst of clarity, like walking out into a cold night and feeling that icy slap of air hit my face, and then I felt gutted every single time. Here is a list of things that have helped me, in no particular order. The episode of Criminal Minds, Season 8, Episode 18, where Derek Morgan confronts his abuser in jail and then vomits alone in the bathroom. The book in Jacqueline Carey's Kushiel's Legacy series, where Phaedra and Jocelyn rescue Imreal. What they go through to rescue him, and that it's worth it to go through that in order to bring him home. Giving up Christmas. Giving up Thanksgiving. Reading what other survivors have to say, in our own words, and not literature by people writing about us, or mental health practitioners having opinions. Stories where survivors tell what happened. Stories where they don't. Stories where they explain why they can't sit with their back to the door in a restaurant, or why they can't use dressing rooms, or how running marathons, or planting orchards, or knitting help them save themselves. All the weird life hacks and tricks they have to get through things. The subcategory of a romance manga in which the beloved has survived abuse of some kind. And the lover never once says the beloved is dirty or unlovable, never acts that way. Where it is just a solid wall of unstoppable love. Hopefully, there is also revenge. Revenge stories, generally, like the scene where Inigo Montoya kills the man who murdered his father, only more so. The revenge does not have to be specifically related to abuse, although that helps. Avoiding media about time travel, the melding of times, flipping back and forth between months or years is too much like flashbacks. Remaining anchored in this timeline is hard enough for me without leaving it for recreational reasons. Cognitive behavioral therapy for the anxiety attacks that brought me to my knees. I chose a therapist who laughed at my jokes and had an office by the sea, so that it was really easy for me after a session to go stare at something bigger than me, bigger than what happened, bigger than anything, and completely uninterested in any of it, just busy being the sea. My sister had to make me go to therapy, though, to talk me into the office over the phone and convince me to sit down in the waiting room, and then convince me to stay there. Because I can be both stubborn and foolish, and she is my older sister, and therefore occasionally the boss of me. If you have someone who is sometimes the boss of you, it can help to give them the job of making you go, at first. Sometimes I imagine black wings. Specifically, I'm lying on my bed at night, on my left side, and I imagine someone climbing in next to me and wrapping long black wings over me. It took a long time to learn that these things helped, and that talking about it did not. When I talked about it, people would cry, or get disgusted, or horrified, or say that they just didn't understand how anyone could do that. Or they would have elaborate thoughts about the failings of our justice system and how it could be better in particular ways that might or might not involve the death penalty. Or they would wish out loud that they could kill my abusers, as though that was a thing they were actually going to do. Frequently, the person I just told would need me to be supportive while they went through a range of emotions and feelings, sometimes very intensely, and then they would usually tell me nothing would change in how they felt about me. And then things would change. People you tell will make comparisons. They will compare you to everyone else they have heard of who has experienced something similar, and they will rate how you are doing according to that metric. Are you more or less functional than their college roommate? Are you more or less sexual than that one woman at the office? Are you thinner or fatter than the other survivors they know? Does it sound like something they heard about on TV? Did they read a book about it? Can they tell their partner about it over dinner that night as a sad story and shake their head? They will want details, as many details as you can give them, until they suddenly don't want details anymore, and it's too much. Then they will revise backward. They will take every opinion they've ever heard from you, every personality trait, every action, and recast them in light of what you told them. This will be particularly true of your sexual behavior and your appearance. Probably this is why you are such a slut. Probably this is why you don't date at all. Probably this explains everything about you, really. Why you fuck the people you fuck, and love the people you love, or do neither, ever. Probably this is why you are such a mess, and they are safe. Even many people who are mostly on your side will think that you must have done something, that it would not happen to them, or to the people they love, because their lives are organized better. They don't take chances. They don't know anyone who would do anything like that. I have had people who are otherwise loving and kind-hearted tell me that they just don't understand how people who go through this can get up in the morning. I have had people tell me that they would rather be dead than be what I am. I have heard people say that they just don't believe that it can be that bad, that PTSD doesn't exist, that families don't do things like that, that I'm just doing it for the attention. I will tell you right now that if someone were to offer me one crisp dollar bill for every single bit of attention being a survivor has ever gotten me, I would take the dollar. Will everyone react that way? No, of course not. And most people who do are not doing so out of malice. They just don't know any better. It still doesn't make it all right. I never want to stop anyone else from telling. For many people, all of the terrible responses are even more of a reason to be open, to be radically honest, to reveal the places that have been hurt the most deeply. It helps lots of survivors to talk about it, and I want us to talk about it whenever and however we want. I will always listen. I want us all to listen. The more of us who come out as survivors, the harder it gets to ignore that there is too much to have to survive. The harder it gets to pretend like this doesn't happen, or it only happens to certain kinds of people. But that doesn't mean you have to give your whole story to anyone who asks. Not telling my story doesn't mean it didn't happen. I don't have to be open about my experiences, about all of them, or even any of them, to be a real survivor. I'm a real survivor because I survived, even if some days it feels like I didn't survive at all. Other people do not get to tell me what my experience means, or where they would like to place me in their pantheons of suffering. There is great danger in letting those around you determine what your experience means to you, and I have found that one of the best ways to combat that is to keep my story for myself. You can keep it to yourself today, until tomorrow, and you can tell everyone you know and then never talk about it again. You don't owe anything to anyone. Your story is not the currency you exchange for love, for understanding, for getting what you need. You are allowed to get what you need without justifying why you need it, regardless of what you choose to reveal and what you keep private. No one is entitled to that part of you, and you have no responsibility, none, to make your experience easier or more palatable by constructing a narrative other people find acceptable. I need the accommodation because I said I need it. I do not do that thing because I have said that I do not do it. No one gets to rake over the details of my life and determine if they think what happened to me was bad enough for me to have earned my scars, my limitations, my superpowers. Broken people understand this better. One of my friends told me a few years ago that she didn't have anyone close to her that had a healthy, functional relationship with their parents because she couldn't relate to people like that. It's not a deliberate exclusion. People with cracked foundations will understand better why sometimes you do crazy shit to shore up your own. It's not that I don't want to love unharmed people. I just don't understand them. The scales are all off. The proportions are wrong for when we talk about how something hurts. This is not a bad day at the office. This is not a breakup. This is not that time that someone really hurt your feelings. It is more like carrying something really heavy forever. You do not get to put it down. You have to carry it, and so you carry it the way you need to, however it fits best. Once I was at a wedding, and a friend of my youth, a person I trust with my life, to whom I have to tell things to make them real, wanted me to go dance with her. We were all super drunk, and I didn't want to, so she grabbed my hair in a totally playful way. We were drunk, and she pulled my hair, and the next thing I knew, I had her up against a wall with my forearm across her throat. She apologized. I apologized. Drunk people are fairly floppy, so nobody got hurt. But I have never forgotten that moment. One second, I was fine. And the next, there was nothing. And then I had one of the people I love most up against a wall. I don't drink like that at parties anymore. I am a happy person most of the time, not just content, not just getting by, but happy. And often so overflowing with joy that I look around myself and revel in my luck, in my work, in my love. I also have a lot of bad days, and a powerful liking for bourbon, and an intimacy problem. All of those things are true. This is what being a survivor looks like for me. Sometimes I see ghosts. The worst ghosts for me are not usually the flashbacks, although those can be pretty bad, but the ones who show me what I might have been if it never happened. It's like suddenly feeling what it would be like to run on a leg that had never been broken just for a second, and then it's gone, and the old bone-deep pain is with me again. I see phantoms in relationships sometimes, certain ways people are with each other that I can't be. I wonder if maybe I would have wanted kids if none of this had happened. Maybe I wouldn't. Maybe that part would have been the same, and it would have just been clearly not for me. But I think I might have, and that life is a ghost for me, haunting, distant, just out of reach across the line of my life. For me, it got better, and worse, and better again. I lost some of the most important people in my life, because they could not stand by me while I was walking into darkness. Others said they would, and then did not, and that changes a person. I am less trusting now. When people say they'll be there, I think, we'll see. But there are rarely days that lay me out now. It's hard to knock me down for long. This many years into living with these scars, into being a person who carries this thing with me, I am fairly adept at it. I can shift the weight of it around. I know what it looks like on different days, how it moves with me through the seasons, through the years. I own my identity. I am a survivor, and I am out as a survivor, and I keep coming out as one over and over again. I am not shy about it, and I am not ashamed. But if people want details, if they want the easily consumable tragedy so that they can file me away somewhere and not have to think about it again, they are not going to get it from me. This story is in the bedrock of me. It's in my bones, what happened, and I have grown around it and over it, and you can't have it. It's mine.
Picture Perfect by Charisse Tracy. Daddy moved us out to California when I was 5. Mommy didn't like it there. I hated being there as an only child, mostly because if I had a brother or sister, I would have had someone to play with. Daddy said that I was spoiled, but I worked more at 13 than he did. Like Cliff Huxtable, he was home a lot while Mommy worked at the phone company. My dad was a freelance photographer who worked steady for a while until he got too sick with sickle cell. I never really saw him in a photo shoot with models or women wanting to be models, but I sure saw the results in his albums. My mom didn't seem to mind about the pictures, or if she did, I didn't know. I never heard them arguing about his photography or the women in the shots. Despite moving around a lot, we always had a dark room where he developed his precious photos. He'd spend hours in there, but I had strict instructions never to enter. He smelled after being in there, a caustic cologne of chemicals and Benson and Hedges from which I was largely spared because he rarely ever even hugged me. The only time I was close to him was when I helped him do test shots. "Stand there and look straight into the lens, Tracy," he'd say. "Don't move." I would stare at the lens or at the tip of his cigarette. I was just a prop, a way to test our new equipment and practice before the occasional big freelance gigs that helped camouflage the fact that he wasn't the primary breadwinner. The year I was 13, my friends and I wanted model-like pictures of ourselves, the glamour shots kind that would eventually infiltrate every mid-American strip mall. Our pubescent hearts were set on mature photos, racy even, in our bathing suits, and we pinned our hopes for them on the one photographer who captured all the young girls in Pasadena, Tate. I'd already tagged along with another girl from school and witnessed her photo session. I knew the setup. Safety was not my concern. "That old guy in the wheelchair," said my mother when I asked. "Oh, no, no, no. I don't trust him." "But, Mom, he takes everyone's pictures in Pasadena." "Cherise," she said, "you don't know what that man could do." At the time, I didn't get what she was implying, but yes, he was pretty much child pornographer number one from Central Casting, an aging hippie in a wheelchair making a living taking pictures of young girls in a dark house. But I never had any problem with him. He'd never said or done anything to me that felt off. "Why not let your daddy take your pictures?" she said. "He takes great photographs." "Daddy?" I'd never thought of my father. Why would I? I knew he took great pictures, but we were talking about glamour shots and swimwear, and he was my father. It wasn't just modesty, though. My father and I didn't have a good relationship because I stubbornly refused to be a son. I would have never thought to ask him for anything remotely supportive. I didn't ask him for anything. But I took my mother's suggestion because I was 13 and impatient. I wanted pictures that made me feel pretty and important, and maybe even a little sexy. And nothing says lightning-fast delivery quite like a man with a camera and darkroom already in your home. When I asked my father to do something for me for the first time ever, I was alone in the house. He said yes and decided to do it right away. My friends, who had always been more skeptical of my mother's suggestion than I was, ended up being busy that day, and so it was just me. Daddy set up our dining room that day to look like a photography studio, putting up the blue backdrop screen that he used with his real models without talking much. He was always very serious when taking pictures. He told me to put on my bathing suit, but I didn't actually have one, despite my plans with my friends. My last known bathing suit had gotten lost in the 6 months we were homeless. According to the boys at school, only my legs, forehead, and smile were getting bigger, not my butt or my breasts. As much as I loved the water, I hadn't had a reason to replace it. All I had was my new blue and white polka dot bra and panty scent that Mommy just bought me from JCPenney. "It's no different than a bikini, Tracy," he said. "Real models wear much less than this." But I wasn't a real model, and he was my daddy. He sent me to get the baby oil from the bathroom, then flipped open the pink top and poured the oil into his hands. He showed me how to apply it the way his real models did. My father rubbed the oil on the uppermost part of my back and shoulders as if he were frosting one of the delicate cakes he baked. He wanted my body to glisten. "Just relax, Tracy. You're doing fine. There's nothing to worry about." I didn't feel fine, but I tried to reassure myself. "I know Daddy is a photographer," I thought. "I know he takes good pictures. I know Mommy thought it was a good idea. She didn't want Old Man Tate to take my pictures. Maybe if Mommy was here, I would be more comfortable. I should say something to Daddy. Tell him I want to wait." I didn't. Instead, I kept telling myself, if I'm ever going to be a real model, I have to get used to this. Finally, the photo shoot ended, and I went to change clothes in my room when he called to me. "Yes, Daddy? I need you to come in here for a minute." Daddy had an idea. He asked me to lie down on the bed for a few shots in my bra and panties. I was confused. All the other pictures were taken in the makeshift dining room studio. "Everything will be okay, Tracy," he said. "Just relax." He laid me down gently and, one hand holding his camera, the other moved the crotch of my brand new blue and white polka dot panties to one side. For once, I was glad I didn't have a little sister. I told Mommy a week later. She looked at me hard, and then she hugged me even harder. She asked why I waited 7 days to tell her, but I didn't have an answer. Mommy didn't say anything else. We just went and rode home from her job in silence. Of course, Daddy denied it. I expected that. I didn't expect Mommy to believe him, and she didn't. So after Daddy finally confessed, I assumed Mommy would throw him out. All along, I had thought that Mommy stayed with Daddy because he was sick and she felt sorry for him. But she didn't make him leave. It was her house, she paid the bills, and she worked. He didn't. Why did she still care for him and let him stay after what he'd done to their daughter? I was so filled with rage I couldn't understand her pain, and I didn't understand her choices. How could she, after all this, love us both equally, maybe even love him a little more than she did me. Even though he raped me, it was treated as something we were both guilty of. I just refused to wear my half of the shame. My father attended our church sporadically. His health was always an excuse for absence, while his photography afforded him plenty of opportunities to be seen at his best. Our pastor, reverends, and deacons all held him in high regard. So when my mother sought advice from our church, it was treated much in the way as the counselor had. No one could believe it. They left us to deal with the matter the best way we knew how, on our own. A counselor coworker of Daddy's warned my mom that she should let him stay because if my father were forced to leave, the overall damage to our family could be irreversible. I thought it very ironic, given all the times my father was unemployed, that it was one of his associates who came to our aid. As a counselor, he volunteered his services to the family as a favor to my father. This doctor, like most of the people my father was in contact with, believed him to be a good and decent man. "Your father told me what happened, Tracy," the counselor said as I sat on the edge of the chair in his hospital office 2 weeks later. "Do you think that you can forgive him?" he asked. My parents sat on the couch on the other side of the room, my mother on one side, gripping her purse, and my father quietly on the other side, his head down and his eyes up. It was the second time in 2 weeks that I'd been asked to forgive something I was struggling to comprehend on the most basic level. Daddy had also asked me for my forgiveness after he stopped denying to my mother that he'd raped me. The psychiatrist paused expectantly, as though I'd missed my cue. "I'll try," I said. "Good, good, good, Tracy," he said. "My name is Charisse," I said. "Only Daddy calls me Tracy." Daddy and his whole family had wanted me to be a boy, so they never used my first name. They all call me Tracy because it conceivably could be a boy's name. "Okay, Tracy. Sorry, Charisse," the so-called counselor droned on. "I've had a long talk with your father. I know him quite well, you know. He's very sorry, and I don't think he will ever do this again. This was just a one-time thing." Daddy's friend was so glib about Daddy raping me, as if it was just a fluke, a regrettable blip on an otherwise unblemished record, like that one time you drove blackout drunk, or that one time you stole your grandmother's purse and did black tar heroin, that one time you raped your only child. "Besides, you'll come back to see me. We'll talk about whatever's confusing you. You're a good girl, Tracy, right? Tell me, Tracy, where's your favorite place to go?" "What do you mean?" I said, without correcting him about my name again. "You know, your favorite place," he said enthusiastically, as if it were a perfectly natural segue from talking about that one time your father raped you, which will totally never happen again, he swears. "I think the three of you should go someplace, as a family. You pick." "I don't know," I said. "Come on, Tracy," he wheedled. "Where's your favorite place to go? Where would you really like to go? Any place at all?" "I just went to Magic Mountain with my eighth grade class." "That's it," he said, clapping his hands with a satisfied grin at my stricken parents. "Magic Mountain, there. Take her to Magic Mountain." When my father was inside me, there was a moment that I didn't cry. The minute before I didn't cry, I tried to scream and realized that no sound was leaving my mouth. So I lay there, eyes shut, and tried to distract myself with thoughts of something that felt good. I pictured the boy who was supposed to be my date for my eighth grade graduation field trip to Magic Mountain. I was in love with that boy for the entire second semester, and I'd felt so special until 2 days before the trip when he dumped me. "Does that feel good, baby?" said my daddy. "Yes." "No," I said, when I registered it was the voice of the man who'd raised me for 13 years and not the boy I'd been trying to focus on. I was feeling pain like I'd never experienced before, tearing, breaking, and throbbing in a place I didn't know I could feel that. The weight on top of me and inside, combined with the heartache that my father was causing, was unbearable. No darkness or daydream could take that away. "No," I said. He continued. "No," I yelled. He paused. "No, no, no," I said, as I held my hands fanned and spread out to try and cover as much of my body as possible. My eyes flew open, and then he resumed thrusting to my cries, as if he were trying to silence me with his pounding. as if he were imagining my screams could be something other than pain and terror. "How does that sound, Tracy?" the hazy blob calling me by my wrong name said, pulling me out of the memory of my rape. "Your parents have agreed to take you to Magic Mountain, all three of you, a family trip." "Fine." Tracy was fine with whatever they said. Charisse was shattered. She wanted to yell and refuse to go and never forgive. But Tracy would say whatever the therapist wanted if they would all leave her and Charisse alone. "This is a good sign, Mom and Dad," he said to my parents, who were still rigid on the opposite couch, not touching, looking anywhere but at my face. "This will be good for all of you." The doctor continued to speak to my parents, and I tried to tune him out, but couldn't entirely. "Divorce is hard on any family," he explained, "but it would be a real tragedy for a black family to divorce. A broken home is the absolute worst thing that can happen to a child." "Worse than getting raped by your father," I thought to myself. "Are any of your friends' parents divorced, Tracy?" "Uh-huh." "You're very lucky to have two parents that love you," he said, as if parents who got divorced love their children less. "What happened to you is a terrible thing, but I don't think it will happen again. Go to Magic Mountain, Tracy, have some fun, and come back to tell me all about it." The more he said it, the more it took on a mystical quality. Magic Mountain. Like it was a bonus quest in Lord of the Rings. Magic Mountain would erase the trauma of my rape, would instill in me some trust in my father that I never had, and would restore our cohesion as a black family. So we went. My father paid for my admission, he bought me a rainbow twirled lollipop from the souvenir shop at the entrance, and even agreed to go on my favorite ride, a roller coaster first, despite the long lines. "Just father and daughter today?" the attendant said cheerfully, when we were finally ushered in. My mother refused to get on a roller coaster. My father smiled but showed no teeth. I just looked at the attendant as he assisted us with our red safety harness. "Give it a tug. Make sure she's safe and secure now," he said. My father pulled on the harness. "She's daddy's little girl," he said. "I'm sure you don't want anything to happen to her." We took off. "Tracy," I heard, just as my toe hit the hallway after a shower. It was as if he'd been listening, waiting for me. "You'll have to wait," I told my father, not looking in his direction. "I need to get dressed." "No, you don't." It was 3 years later. I was 16. My hand clutched the brown antique doorknob when I turned to look at him. "What?" "I just want to look at you. Just look." I stared in disbelief. "Let me look and you can practice your driving hours in my truck." It wasn't going to stop. He was never going to stop. The therapist, my mother, they had been so wrong. I knew then that I wasn't safe. How could I ever be safe sleeping just one room away from my rapist? And I ran to the kitchen to grab a knife. My father was in the doorway of his bedroom when I returned, waiting. I brandished the knife, but my rage only seemed to amuse him. He raised his eyebrows and I lunged toward him, but my towel slipped off, landing at his feet on the midnight blue carpet, and 3 years of running from him, avoiding him, carefully concealing myself, of constant vigilance was all undone. I was naked before him. He'd gotten everything he wanted, and all he'd had to do was wait. I knew what was next on his wish list. "You are a sick motherfucker," I yelled, running into my bedroom and pushing the heavy five-dresser bureau in front of my door. I wasn't sure if I was protecting myself from my father's advances or myself from a murder charge. "Who do you think you're talking to, Tracy?" he admonished. He was deranged, I thought, thinking he could slip back into fatherly privilege just moments after he propositioned me, his daughter, like a $5 hooker. "Come near me and I'll kill you," I yelled. There was no safe place for me to go, no relatives nearby, or close family friends that I could trust. I'd lost all my faith in adults, so I called my friend Robin to pick me up. She wasn't afraid of adults. I also called my mother. "Your husband did it again," I spat in a mix of shouting, crying, screaming, and yelling. "He did it again." "What are you talking about?" my mother asked, as if she had no idea what it could possibly be. "He did it again," I shouted toward the bottom receiver, and I hung up the phone. The phone rang, but my father answered it right away. I looked out the window, waiting for Robin to arrive before I moved the bureau. I would have gone out the window, but they were all nailed shut. Shortly after he raped me, my father caught me with a boy and thought that not being able to open the windows would keep me inside. As far as I was concerned, the real danger was on this side of the glass. A horn honked outside, and I struggled to push the bureau away from the door and be quiet. But my footsteps were loud once they hit the hardwood floors in the living room. Then I heard the horn again, three times more frantic. Time to go. "Where do you think you're going, young lady?" The sound of his voice right after the horn made me jump. I knew if I got the door open and Robin saw me that I'd be safe. I just needed the door open. I rushed to unlock both the deadbolt and the bottom lock and flung it wide. "You're not going anywhere," he said, as I stepped onto the porch. "Just keep walking," I said to myself. "Ignore him, Charisse. Just keep moving." "But it's impossible." "Leave me alone before I tell them what you just did," I said, turning back. His secret was my one available weapon, and being outside gave me more courage. Our neighbor across the street was standing in his driveway. Our next-door neighbor, Andy, was smoking on his porch, and the Mexican family two doors down was in their yard. "You better get your little butt back in this house." Robin honked again. "Charisse, come on," she called. "Just get in the car." "But he did it again." I started to cry. I wanted her to understand why, safely outdoors, I couldn't just walk away without him admitting it. My father insisted that I come back in the house, infuriated at me and embarrassed in front of our neighbors. "Tell them," I shouted, suddenly brave with rage and a public audience. "Tell them how you tried to fuck me just now so I could drive your piece of shit truck." He blinked in the sunlight, registering what I'd screamed in front of so many witnesses. "Be quiet, little girl," he hissed. "Let's go, Charisse." In all the noise, I didn't immediately hear my mother's heels on the sidewalk. "What's going on here?" she asked, taking in the scene in our driveway. I was angry at my mother for the look of surprise on her face. What did she expect, after all? It's not like he changed the way he treated me after the incident. Nothing changed. "Ask your husband," I said, and got in the car. I lived with Robin for a short time, but as much as I'd always wanted siblings, her house was too busy. Brothers and bullies from school had free rein at her house, and some of Robin's best friends were girls who had threatened to beat me up. I decided it was better to take my chances at home, where I knew what to expect. Maybe my pulling a knife on my father showed him I wasn't the one to be fucked with. After I moved back in, I wrote a series of letters to adults, family members, people from church, and good friends of my mother who also happened to be her co-workers, getting their addresses from my mother's telephone book and stealing stamps from her wallet. In the letters, I wrote that my father had tried to rape me a second time, and I had run away from home but couldn't stay where I'd been. I asked for each person to send me money because my part-time job after school wasn't enough to allow me to get a place on my own. My mother's father in Philly got a letter, even though Grandpa and I weren't really close. A nice lady at church who was a friend of my mother's, and she was always nice to my father, got one. She was a woman, and I thought she would help. My mother's co-worker, who had a daughter my age, got one. She made me tacos when I was 8, and I spent the night at her house, so I was sure she would help. I expected return letters with checks within 2 weeks, and every day I opened the black, squeaky mailbox lid hoping for letters addressed to me. After a month passed, it was clear that no one was going to write me back. A few months later, an uncle died in Philadelphia, and my mom went out for the funeral. After she got back, she told me that my grandfather asked if things were okay because he received a letter from me with some horrible lies in it. She told me she cried when she read the letter he'd kept and told her father that it was true. "Did he say why he didn't send me money?" I asked her. "He said he assumed you were lying and making up stories for attention," my mother said. "But once you told him it was true?" He didn't say anything. I later learned that all of my letters reached their addressees. Every single one of the people I sent them to had a conversation with my mother about them. The general consensus boiled down to one dismissive phrase that unified them all. "That's y'all's business." Your daddy is dying, my mother said to me when 19-year-old me got home from my new full-time job as a receptionist. My husband of 7 months and I had decided to live with her because my father had been sick, and he'd been splitting his time between a psychiatric and medical hospital for most of that year. The stays were longer each time he'd go in, and the few times I'd seen him, he looked more and more decrepit. I figured as much, didn't seem to be the response she was looking for. Whenever my mother delivered any news about my father, she looked at me and waited, like I hadn't done enough for him. Like today was the day my heart would thaw and have this outpouring of sympathy for him. Sympathy that would absolve her for choosing her man over her child every time. The look pissed me off. Had she forgotten that I'd been the one in the house with her these past years, with him? No daughter should have to help her rapist father get to the doctor because he's in pain. Did she not realize how hard it was for me to look past him and focus on her, just to get him to the help that he needed? He needs your forgiveness, Charisse, she said. I think he's holding on for it. But we'd played that game years ago with the therapist. He'd been sorry. Tracy said she forgave him, and he tried to rape me again anyway 3 years later. Now that he was dying, the only difference was that we were 99.9% sure he wouldn't have the strength to rape me. I told my mother no. She stared at me through her glasses. I'd disappointed her. The feeling was mutual. Later that evening, my husband, Bryant, and I spoke about my decision to not visit my father. He wanted me to go. Just go so he can die in peace. Bryant was a good person, and I wanted to be a good person for him. But it bothered me that it was more important that my dad found peace than that I did. Bryant knew what my father had done, but they had somehow still bonded. Everyone who came in contact with my father liked him. It made me sick whenever I saw them together laughing, joking, and exchanging small talk in our living room. It was bad enough that they had my body in common. I hated that they'd found more than that. We made plans to go see my father the next day. It was difficult to go to work with the weight of forgiveness on my shoulders. After, my husband met me at the hospital. As we turned the corner and reached the nurse's station, I recognized people and heard voices, friends of the family, church members, co-workers of my mother, all there for my father. People parted to let me by and whispered, shaking their heads in disapproval. Somehow the shame was still on me, the victim. My father was to be absolved in death, as he had been in life. My husband gripped my hand. "Do you want me to go with you?" he asked. "No," I said. My mother offered as well, but I didn't want either of them in the room with me. I figured that I might as well finish with my father as I had started with him, alone. The room smelled like I imagined death would. Flannel blankets and Clorox, camouflaged in a potpourri of church lady powder and perfumes. My father had tubes coming out of every opening that I'd allow myself to look at. His chapped lips parted, but no audible words came out. He motioned with the hand nearest me to sit. His eyes were dull and quiet, but they followed my every move. "Do you want more light?" I asked. He motioned me again to sit in the chair next to his bed. A large clear tear ran down his cheek. My father turned his hand over to the backside so the tube hit the bed and raised it up and down. He wanted my hand. I hesitated, and he did it again. Another tear. I put my hand on top of his and turned my head toward the door, unable to watch his final act of touching me. He curled his fingers toward the center. I didn't move. The sound of him trying to find his voice scared me. "You don't have to talk," I said. "I'm sorry," he said in a small voice. More tears fell, disappeared under the tube, and reemerged. "I know," I said. "I forgive you, Daddy." I was lying, but I knew he would believe me because he wanted to. He waited for it. Everyone in the hall had been waiting for the lie so they could feel better about themselves. I sat for as long as I could stand to have my hand in his. I leaned over and brushed his paper-thin cheek with my lips. Goodbye. That goodbye wasn't the end, of course. I still carry the weight of being a rape survivor and of the demand that I forgive and forget to uphold the myth of the perfect black family. I carry the weight handed to me by the black moral majority who ignored my father's crimes and who knows how many other men's, who tried to buy off a terrified 13-year-old with a one-day trip to an amusement park. They were so desperate to project the image of the respectable, righteous, picture-perfect black family to the world that they were willing to let the women and girls in those pictures suffer. I never asked to be a model minority. I just wanted, for a few minutes, to believe I could be a model.
To Get Out From Under It by Stacey May Fowles. I said the word no 16 times. I don't know that I truly remember exactly how many times I said no, especially given the circumstances. The passage of time blots out any kind of vivid, detailed memory, and the world fills you with doubt over the legitimacy of your own story. But for whatever reason, that's the number that I repeat in my head. It's the number that I used when I finally started talking about what happened to me. It's the number that I told counselors and psychiatrists and whispered to close friends in quiet, covert moments. 16. It's almost sad that my fragile memory picked out that number to use every time I tell the story. As if saying no 16 times is so many more than one that it makes my claim of violation more valid. I said no more than a dozen times. Does that sound better than saying it once? Exactly how many times did I need to say no to make what happened to me wrong and worthy of care? On a cold afternoon in May, I arrived for my appointment at the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Care Center to find that someone had given its clients a package of brightly colored chalk. With it, the clients had written all over the institutional beige waiting room walls. I sit down and wait for my counselor to collect me, absently scanning the multicolored aftermath. I assume the graffiti was allowed because today is the last day the center will be open, that the scrawl is appropriate only because the aging building is closing, its contents and staff moving to their bright and shiny brand new home. The new crisis center, I'm told, will be more accommodating, more hopeful, more comfortable. It will have tighter security and a greater sense of anonymity. It will be better able to protect its most vulnerable clients, the women who live in fear of their abusers and are worried they'll be found. The future waiting room will be less claustrophobic, its furnishings better than a worn salmon pink velour living room set inherited from a generous staff member. Of course, I know it will be better, that everyone who works here, I'm told, has been looking forward to the move for months. But I still feel a pang, a sense of loss at the building's closure. I've spent a great deal of time here over the past few years. It is the humble, private place where I've finally stared at so many things head-on. A secret refuge that became safe and predictable while everything else seemed untethered. The outdated furnishings and faded paint job belie the medical environment in which they are housed. Though designed to make me better, this place never made me feel that I was broken. A client who sat in this room before me added a quote by feminist writer Nawal el-Sadawi in bright red. "I speak the truth, and the truth is savage and dangerous," it reads. To my right, another survivor has scrawled, "Silence will not be my enemy," in blue chalk, above what I assume is her full name, the date of her rape, and the name of her rapist. Everyone here wants to say a terrible thing out loud. So many are stifled by lives that keep them silent. This is the place in which we are all finally safe to speak about the awful secret things that have happened to us, and unveil the disturbing thoughts that have plagued us for hours, days, months, and years as a result. Here at the crisis center, no one will tell on us, yet I still struggle with speaking the truth. In the safety of these tiny clinic rooms, when I hear my voice articulate what I've been through and how it's made me feel over so many years, I often feel like it can't be real. I recount and recount again as if to remind myself that yes, something terrible happened to me. Yes, that's the reason I turned out this way. I doubt I'll ever really be sure how I ended up in this place, how my life brought me here, despite the fact that I've gone over it again and again in my mind. The brightly colored box of chalk is still open, its contents splayed out on the heavy wood coffee table, but today I have nothing to write. What I remember. I was face down when he pinned down my wrists, one at each side of my body,
His hands were strong and large and rough, but they were, before the moment that he held me down, hands that I had wanted to touch me. I struggled against him when, for a brief moment, he finally loosened his grip, and I saw a possible window of escape. I made a futile effort to cover myself with my hands and push him off.